As you might notice, the title of my talk is fairly generic today. The main reason for that is that there are actually two slightly separate topics that I would like to cover. The first, which will be the main part of my talk, is numerical simulations of compact binary mergers, especially black hole neutron star and neutron star neutron star mergers, which are among the most promising sources of gravitational wave for advanced LIGO, as well as sources of powerful electromagnetic signals that we hope to observe in conjunction with those gravitational waves. The second part of the talk will be simulations against and modeling of accretion disks around supermassive black hole, and in particular focusing on the regime in which the black hole is accreting very slowly, in which case you expect the plasma forming the accretion disk to be largely collisionless. And we'll see how that can affect the dynamics of those accretion disks. And that regime is important in part because most supermassive black holes are expected to be fairly slowly accreting, and also because the two supermassive black holes, which are the easiest to resolve from Earth, and which are going to be observed by the Event Horizon Telescope, are thought to be in that slowly accreting regime. So from a theoretical point of view, there is a fair amount of overlap between those two topics. Both require numerical simulations of fluids in a general relativistic framework, and are both are tied to upcoming experiments, which are going to give us a new insight into the behavior of astrophysical system in a strong gravity regime. But for the purpose of this talk, because they are very different astrophysical beasts, I'm going to treat them largely separately. Let's start with the binary merger systems, and first is the way in which we hope to observe them in the next few years. The most important, maybe, and the most exciting would be gravitational waves, which, as most of you probably know, are the simplest solution to Einstein's equation of general relativity, which is propagating linear perturbation of flat space, which we can hope to observe through their effect on on oscillations of relative distances between test masses in orthogonal directions. We have not observed gravitational waves directly so far. That's what we are hoping to do, but we have observed them indirectly, fairly securely, and in particular in the evolution of binary neutron star systems, such as the Hulse-Taylor binary, which you can see that the evolution of the orbital parameter of the system follows exactly what you would expect from Einstein's theory of general relativity, including the emission of gravitational waves. But we would like to detect them directly, and we would like also to detect them in a regime in which gravity cannot be expressed as a simple perturbation of Newtonian theory, but instead in which you are in the strong field regime. And that's what Advanced LIGO is going to do. Advanced LIGO started to take data this September with the new updated detector, and at design sensitivity by the end of the decade or so, probably see of the order of tens of events per year. Also, there is an uncertainty of more than an order of magnitude on that number. It could be, well, it's always at least one a year, and it could be as much as hundreds, but if we are lucky, or maybe even 1,000. So in the case of black hole neutron star and neutron star merger, not black hole, there's also an additional way in which we can observe the system, which is bright electromagnetic signatures. The brightest of them all is probably going to be short gamma ray bursts. I can get into that later, but there is a fairly strong theoretical interpretation of gamma ray bursts as coming from a binary neutron star or black hole neutron star merger, but no actual observational proof so far. And actually getting that connection by observing in conjunction gamma ray bursts and gravitational waves would go a long way towards proving that we understand what's going on. We think that they come from accretion disk black hole system forming some merger, and in particular when they power an ultra-relativistic strongly beamed jet, which actually emits those gamma rays. We would like to know how often this happens. We would like to know for which binary system this happens, and we would like to understand by what mechanism we go from merging neutron stars or neutron star black hole systems to a short gamma ray burst. One important thing that we can get beyond proving the connection between gamma ray bursts and gravitational waves, if we observe the system through electromagnetic signals, is we can get improved localization. Improved localization will first improve our ability to extract the parameters of the system from the gravitational wave signal, and second, give us a lot of information about the environment in which those binary mergers occur. You can get the localization very well from gravitational waves. You can't get it very well either from the gamma rays, but you can get it from the afterglow of the gamma ray burst, which once you actually know that there is a gamma ray burst, it's probably going to be looked at by, yeah?
How good a localization do you need to make a
difference? Well, I suppose it depends what you're looking at, but ideally you would want to know associated with the galaxy, and then be able to ideally even say how far from the center of the galaxy it is, so, which is the kind of thing that you can do if you have infrared optical detections, but not gamma ray, I guess.
Do you really need sub-arc-second localizations in order to say things about the parameters of the merging system?
No, for the parameters of the merger system, you can do, no, I was thinking of the environment. No, for the parameters of the merger, if you can already break some degeneracies in the localization, you can already get some extra information. I'm not quite sure how that would what it would scale with the exact accuracy localization. But, so I would guess that you can already get something useful just from the gamma ray observation. Yeah. The problem with strong gamma ray bursts is that by nature, at least if we understand them, they are strongly beamed. And so of all the gamma ray bursts happening around us, we only are going to observe a few percent, maybe. And that means that if you see tens of LIGO events per year, and only some of them power short gamma ray bursts, it's going to be a rare event in which you can observe both of them at the same time. Maybe a more promising source of electromagnetic signal from that point of view are radioactively powered transients, which, as we will see, are due to radioactive decay in neutron-rich material unbound by some merger. This is thought to give rise to a signal which is probably occurring in the infrared on a time scale of a week after the merger, or so in some circumstances it could be in the optical on a shorter time scale, or even in the ultraviolet. It's a lot fainter than gamma ray bursts, but you observe gamma ray bursts much farther than the LIGO horizon, and this is thought to be somewhat at the limit of what telescopes that are going to be active at the same time as advanced LIGO are going to be able to observe. So it's, for most of the events, because this emission is more isotropic, this is probably a more likely source of an electromagnetic counterpart than the gamma ray burst. It can also give us localization as the gamma ray burst, but on top of that, it carries information about the properties of the merging binaries through the relation between the properties of the unbound material and the actual light curve that you are going to observe. As opposed to gamma ray bursts, there is no certain detection of such an event, just a first candidate that was observed as one extra emission of infrared in the infrared in the afterglow of a gamma ray burst about 2 years ago, which is consistent with the models for radioactively powered transients, but it's just one data point, and we don't understand the infrared afterglow of gamma ray bursts that well, so it would be nice to confirm it in both in conjunction with gravitational waves or with more data points in the afterglow of other gamma ray bursts. Okay, so that's the main ways, at least, in which we are going to observe those mergers. There are also possibilities to observe them in the radio, which is difficult because it's on a very long time scale and also very much at the border of what radio telescope might hope to do. I'm not going to get into that in this talk. What we can learn from those detections beyond, of course, the existence of gravitational waves and their connection, the connections between mergers and the various events that I just described, gamma ray burst and odd flows, is first whether the gravitational wave matches potentially the what you would expect from general relativity, which is actually difficult things to do because we only have predictions for general relativity and for a few specific cases of alternative theories of gravity, in particular Lewis simulation using a scalar tensor gravity. But for most alternative theories of gravity, we don't have predictions, so it makes it a bit hard to actually determine whether we have such an alternate waveform or not. We can also infer information about all the messy astrophysics that occur before the merger from the from two binary main sequence star, two main sequence star in a binary to a black hole neutron star or neutron star neutron star mergers, which involves what happens when there is mass transfer between the two stars, what happens during the supernova explosion, what the result of the supernova explosion is, and so on. That is a fairly tricky inversion to do because we are going to have to do that just from knowing between the merger rate and the mass and spin distribution of black hole neutron stars. So we are going to be able to put constraints on the result of population synthesis models, which use all of that, But it's going to be very hard to pinpoint as one specific part of the process here and see how this is why we see 7 solar mass black holes in mergers. 2 points that I would like to look at more details in this talk, on the other hand, are first the connection between potential measurement of neutron star radii and using that to put constraints on unknown nuclear physics. And the second will be what we can learn from trying to constrain our process nuclear synthesis in those mergers. So let's look at that in a little bit more details. First, the nuclear physics part and the equation of state of neutron star. From an experimental point of view, we have information about low density matter. We have information about very hot high density matter in colliders. But we do not have experimental data about very cold, very dense neutron-rich matter as in the center of neutron star. They are theoretical models, but they come with a fair amount of uncertainty. And for any of those models, you can effectively derive a mass-radius relationship, which is what astrophysically you are likely to be able to measure, either the mass or the radius of a neutron star. And if you can put astrophysical constraints on that mass-radius relationship, you can actually start to excite information which constrains unknown nuclear physics. There are 2 particularly important things to look at on those mass-radius relationships. The first is that there is always a maximum mass that can support a neutron star, and constraining that can significantly constrain your nuclear physics. In particular, recently, the discovery of 2 solar mass neutron stars has ruled out a fair number of models. And if we could measure an even higher mass neutron star, you would rule out even more models. And second, you can actually start to measure the radius of a standard neutron star, 1.2 to 1.4 solar mass neutron stars, and use that to rule out also potential models. So there are some existing measurement of neutron star radii, mostly from X-ray binaries, but those comes with somewhat controversial systematic errors. And so actually getting either better measurement or measurement with different systematics from gravitational wave observations would be a very nice thing to do, or from the electromagnetic counterparts of those mergers. So where does that come in the gravitational wave? Well, during the InSPAL, a larger neutron star is through its tidal deformation is going to emit more gravitational waves and InSPAL faster. So the larger, here you have 2 waveforms, one for a black hole, one for an equivalent neutron star, or I think in this case black hole neutron star IP system, and the one with the neutron star InSPAL faster due to tidal dissipation. So you can hope to measure that phase difference at merger because you can you have before that 30 minutes of evolution at which you can match the rest of the waveform, which and the tidal effects really only matter at the very end of the evolution. You can also hope to get something from the post-merger signal in the black hole neutron star from the disruption of the neutron star, which cuts off the gravitational wave signal. And the neutron star neutron star merger, if you form a very massive neutron star as a result of the merger, which is thought to happen in a large number of cases at least, you get an excited neutron star remnant which brings down a very well-defined frequency which depends on the equation of state, and we are going to see that that's something that you can actually predict fairly well at this point. And now let's look at the other point that I wanted to make, our process nuclear synthesis. There's another important consequence potentially of neutron star mergers is that it is possible that it is the place where most of the elements produced to rapid neutron capture are produced in the universe. We think that there are basically 2 processes by which you produce heavy elements, heavier than roughly zinc, in the universe. The first is the slow neutron capture process in which elements are going to capture a neutron and beta decay and capture a neutron following the value of stable elements. And there is the rapid process in which you subject your nuclei to a very large neutron flux, and then they absorb a lot of neutrons and form very heavy neutron-rich elements which are highly unstable. And when the neutron flux falls down, you are going to decay back towards the stable elements, but with abundances that are very different than from the S process. And so you can see in the universe we have a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. We don't really know where the R process occurs. You need a neutron-rich environment, so the ejecta from neutron star neutron star or black hole neutron star merger is a fairly natural guess, but we would like to check whether the event rate and mass emission ejection that you observe in those merger is actually consistent with the abundances of those elements that we observe in the universe, or if we need another source of R process, the leading contender being core collapse supernovae. Yes?
Can you go back one slide? I have one question. When you say you can detect whether the remnant forms a black hole, do you mean you can see the mass and then see whether it's above the threshold, or there's some direct signal tells you whether they are forming a black hole?
Well, when it comes to black hole, there's mostly a lack of signal by that point. That's why I'm not sure that the time of collapse to a black hole is going to be extremely constraining, because at this point we don't really have a very good handle on it, even theoretically. If we could, and you could actually measure when the emission stops, that could be something you can do, but I think that's higher order than just measuring those frequencies. The frequencies is really the thing that, but you need it, you need the remnant to live long enough that you can actually, that you have enough power in that mode to actually measure it. Right, so if you immediately collapse to a black hole, you are not going to get any of that. That answer your question? Okay, so let me know then move on to the actual result of simulation. We have seen how we are going to observe the system and a couple of the important points that we would like to extract from those simulations, that is the equation of state of neutron star and where our process nucleosynthesis occurs. Now let's look at qualitatively what is the result of black hole neutron star and neutron star neutron star mergers. And first, black hole neutron star binaries. A numerical simulation tells us that there are basically two potential outcomes for black hole neutron star merger. Either the neutron star gets close to the black hole, overflows its Roche lobe, and undergoes unstable mass accretion onto the black hole. Most of the matter just falls into the black hole. Some of it is ejected from the system, and the rest forms an accretion disk black hole system, which is a fairly good progenitor for a short gamma ray burst. In the second case, the neutron star gets closer and closer to the black hole as it emits gravitational waves. It gets slightly distorted, but not enough to overflow its Roche lobe before reaching the innermost stable circular orbit, at which point it just plunges into the black hole and you are left with nothing. This is, of course, a much less interesting case if you are interested in electromagnetic counterpart after the merger, because you are not going to get any sort of radioactively powered transient, you are not going to get any sort of short gamma ray burst from this kind of system.
But you could have an electromagnetic
counterpart. You could have a pre-merger electromagnetic counterpart, certainly, yes. Yeah. So those are generally fainter than the others. And here's one example of what can happen in neutron star neutron star binaries for relatively low mass stars, which the neutron star gets close together again due to gravitational wave emission, and then are going to collide and form a very massive differentially rotating remnant surrounded by a sort of an accretion disk, but very strongly asymmetric with strong tidal arms and sharks in the disk.
Does it eventually collapse, or does it?
It depends. It depends on the total mass, so I get to that. So we can actually, from numerical simulations, now have a fairly good understanding of which of the different outcomes will happen in black hole neutron star neutron star neutron star merger. In black hole neutron star merger, it's very simple to determine the limit between those two. And basically, if you have a low black hole spin, the innermost stable circular orbit is farther out, so it's harder to disrupt the neutron star. If you have a high black hole mass, because the radius of the skew scales like the mass of the black hole, while the tidal disruption radius scales like the mass of the one-third, a high black hole mass is also bad for disruption. And a small neutron star, of course, is bad for disruption because it's more strongly bound. And we can actually determine the limit between those two cases. And for a typical black hole mass of 7 to 10 solar mass and a typical neutron star radius of maybe 10 to 12 kilometers, you end up requiring a spin of order of 0.7 to 0.9 dimensional spin. So fairly large spin aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Only the components aligned with the orbital angular momentum really matters. So this gives you a first distinction. And if you see an electromagnetic counterpart from a black hole neutron star merger, you already know that you are in this configuration if it's a gamma ray burst or if it is a relatively powered transient. If you see something weaker at earlier times, then maybe not. In the neutron star neutron star case, the main determinant of the outcome is the total mass of the system. If your total mass is, roughly speaking, more than about 1.4 times the maximum mass of a neutron that can be supported by a neutron star, which we don't know but are trying to determine, you are going to immediately collapse the central object to a black hole and form again a black hole plus accretion disk system. So you are going to end up with the same kind of potential electromagnetic counterparts, at least to first order, as in the disrupting black hole neutron star case. But if you have a lower mass system, you are going to have a hypermassive remnant, which may be entirely stable if it's less than the maximum mass of a neutron star, which can be supported by a uniform rotation if it's somewhere between that maximum mass and about 20% more, or only supported by differential rotation, in which case it might collapse to a black hole on a fairly short time scale, tens or hundreds of milliseconds. In this case, on top of the Dirichlet counterpart, you also have a very strong, a potentially strong post-merger gravitational wave signal from the ringing of the remnant.
So the 1.4 is that?
It's approximate.
How approximate
is migration? I would guess maybe 5%, something like that, around there. But we don't really have enough simulations with very good equation of state to actually be sure. So, and we don't necessarily. Yeah, I guess no. It's also arbitrary in where you put the limit, or how fast you want to collapse to a black hole in order to say that you're in this case or in this case. I think yeah, within you know maybe 1.35 or 1.45. I don't know. It probably depends on the equation of state. I'm not sure we have enough simulations to actually be sure of those errors at this point. It's really roughly speaking, yeah, but it really depends on your relation to the mass of the system.
But it's not just strictly the bound that is set. So I mean, there's the maximum mass for non-rotating neutron stars. There's the maximum mass for
Right. So this is for the differentially rotating neutron star. So which is going to, if you cannot even support a differentially rotating neutron star, then you are going to immediately collapse. Yeah, the 1.2 to 1.4, roughly speaking, again, is where you can support a differentially rotating neutron star, but not a uniformly. You can support only if you have a differentially rotating neutron star. Yes, and then of course. It's going to collapse on the time scale for the angular momentum to be redistributed, which is much shorter than the spin down time, which.
You also got thermal pressure, you got some. And that same, you can put it off.
Yeah, that. My impression from at least what Jeff Kaplan did at Caltech is that it's not as important as the angular momentum here, but it's. I think that's probably still an open question, yeah. All right, so let's look in a little bit more details now at some of the gravitational wave and electromagnetic predictions that have been made by numerical relativity and analytical work, and what we can already say about those at this point. First, let's look at the gravitational wave signal from the INSPIRAL, which we hope to use to constrain, again, the radius of the neutron star from the tidal dephasing observed between point particle gravitational waves and gravitational waves in which you include the finite size of the neutron star. Studies of population of neutron star neutron star binaries have shown that with the typical 1 year of LIGO data, so 40 events, let's say 40 events rather than 1 year, given the uncertainties, you can actually get constraints that start to be very meaningful for nuclear physics, so of order of maybe a kilometer error in the radius of your neutron star. Now, to do that, of course, you actually need a model which is accurate to that kind of error, that is about 10% in the radius of the neutron star. And the problem is that at this point, we are definitely not there. I'm going to show you here plots that was given to me by Tanya Hinder at the EEI, summarizing a number of the of those points. The baseline here is the phase of the of a numerical simulation from a neutron star black hole binary. The black line tells you the phase difference for a point particle waveform, which we have fairly well under control. And then all of those other lines are different analytical models, including tides. The blue is pretty much a standard inclusion of tides in those models, which is still in fairly strong disagreement with the numerical waveform. The blue is the light blue is a more recent model, including some kind of fitting to numerical relativity already. And the red curves are models which actually include a dynamical evolution of the tides here, of the tidal effects here, of the Love number actually. which for most of the actually of the Inspire here comes within the numerical errors, which are this gray area here, which hopefully you can see. And so between those different models here, which are still work in progress, you still get errors which are at least 30% of the total effect. And so that means that the models have not converged yet to the accuracy required to actually make those kind of measurements. On top of that, the numerical simulation itself has an error which is 20% of the effect. And so the numerical simulations haven't converged either to a point where it can actually help us constrain the models. So there's definitely an improvement of effect of a few that we need here if we want to use these effects in order to make those measurements. Yeah.
This is a rather kind of pernicious case, but the Q equal 1, not equal mass ratio between the black hole and the
inspire. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we want to use that to constrain the analytical part. But it's going to be much more useful for neutron star, neutron stars, of course. But realistic black hole neutron star, the tidal effects are so small that you're not going to get anything out of them. It's just that this is a waveform where we have the best accuracy that we have. So that's the one we have been using. Effectively, if you had a neutron star, neutron star, the effect would be twice as big. But this is a relatively big neutron star. It's a 14 kilometer neutron star. So the effect would actually be smaller for a realistic neutron star. So it's roughly the right order of magnitude for the effect that you expect at merger. It's always a few radiant, right, at merger. But yes, I agree that neutron star black hole are not the way to go to actually measure those effects, because for a realistic black hole of 7 to 10 solar mass, that effect is going to be minuscule. Let me briefly say something about the merger and post-merger signal. In black hole neutron star, you get a very clear, so this is a spectrum of the gravitational waves plotted here against different LIGO noise spectrum. These three curves here show you different neutron star radii. You can see a different cutoff of the gravitational waves of the neutron star distributed at a different point. This is a difficult measurement to make, though, because it's at like 1.5 to 2 kilohertz, which is not really the most sensitive band for advanced LIGO. And in the case of black hole neutron star merger, it mostly depends on the compactness of the neutron star, but it has also some influence of the mass of the black hole, the spin of the black hole. It's going to be a fairly difficult inversion to make, even if you had a signal large enough to make it, which is by no way guaranteed, actually pretty unlikely. A more promising system, again, for this is neutron star, in which you can actually see clear peaks. So this is a spectrogram of the gravitational waveform from roughly the time of merger to about 8 milliseconds afterwards. And you have clear peak at high frequency, which depend on the equation of state in a way that has now been fairly well, in my opinion, modeled based on a large number of non-GR simulations, but actually confirmed in GR simulations by both Carlos Palenzuela and myself. And these equations of state are only different by about 1 kilometer in radius. So they are pretty close to each other as far as trying to put constraint on nuclear physics is concerned. And they already have very clearly distinct peak for that frequency. But again, it is at 2.5 to 3 kilohertz, which is not the most sensitive region for advanced LIGO. And so it's going to require a very bright event if we want to actually observe this. But one event, if you can measure that frequency once, it already gives you a lot of information. And from a theoretical point of view, I think we are on much safer ground in associating this frequency with the underlying nuclear physics than we are currently in the Inspire effects, where the models have not quite converged yet. All right. How much time do I have left?
Half an hour.
Half an hour? Okay, good. So let's talk a bit about all flows then and our process nucleosynthesis. As we have seen in the movies earlier, black hole neutron star, when they disrupt, and neutron star pretty much all the time, are going to eject some amount of material during the merger. And that material is going to undergo nucleosynthesis, which depends on the initial composition of the outflows. Mainly, if you have a fairly neutron-rich outflow, so here I'm plotting, I'm showing results from Wanajo and collaborators in Japan, showing the mass number, relative production of different elements as a function of mass number. And the quantity that you vary here is Ye, which is the electron fraction, also the number of protons divided by the total number of nucleons. If you have a very neutron-rich material, which is a low Ye, you robustly form those heavy elements here with very marked peaks which are also observed in the solar system and in low metallicity stars. If you have a less neutron-rich material, something around an electron fraction of at least 0.2 to 0.3, depending on the entropy of the material, you are going to instead form lower mass elements closer to iron. And so the actual result of your R-process nucleosynthesis depends very sensitively on at least on whether you're on one side or the other of that limit. And what determines this electron fraction is neutrino matter interactions in your merger. And so in order to capture this effect, you would have to have a good modeling of the neutrinos in your simulations. It also, the result of R-process nucleosynthesis also has an important impact on the actual electromagnetic signal that you will see from those mergers. If you have strong R-process, so the formation of those heavy elements, you also form very high opacity lanthanides element. And that means that your electromagnetic signal is going to be delayed and usually occur in the infrared instead of the optical if you do not have high opacity material. So the high opacity material is going to stop your radiation from free streaming away from your ejecta for longer, and it is going to also reduce the amplitude and delay the signal. So if you have a weak R process, no formation of heavy elements, you are going to end up with something like a day-long transient at optical wavelength. And if you have strong R process, formation of those heavy elements, you end up with a mostly weak long transient at infrared wavelength. So you can get some information about actually the composition of your ejecta from which type of transient you see. And it also depends on things like the total mass ejected, of course, as well as the velocity of the ejecta, which is going to set the time scale in details. All right, so if you want to do this, now we have to actually treat the neutrino in your simulations. The problem is that to do that, in theory, you would need to evolve the distribution functions of neutrinos, of each species of neutrinos, which is a function of space and momentum of the neutrinos. It's a seven-dimensional problem, which is currently too costly to be included in the full 3D simulations. So there are currently two main approximate schemes that have been used in numerical simulations for neutron star interstellar and black hole interstellar mergers. The simplest is a local cooling prescription in which locally you estimate how many neutrinos you are losing through either free emission or, if you're in an optically sick region, diffusion through your system with from some estimate of the optical death of your system to neutrinos, because those disks and neutron stars are so dense that they are optically sick to neutrinos in some cases. The leakage scheme is very simple and cheap. It gives you an order of magnitude estimate of the cooling time scale and of the composition evolution within the disk in many circumstances, which is actually fairly reliable. But it can't predict the composition of the outflows. And if you have a very inhomogeneous disk, it also fails at predicting the composition within the disk. One step further than the leakage scheme is to actually try to follow the neutrinos through your grid and do a transport scheme. We can't do the full transport problem. We do instead a moment formalism in which we evolve the energy density of neutrino and the flux density of neutrino in a gray scheme, so no energy dependence at this point. And then you use an analytical closure for the next moment in momentum space of the neutrino distribution function, which is the neutrino pressure tensor. And that analytical prescription is somewhat arbitrary and introduced some error in evolution, in particular the fact that you are not capable of handling neutrinos coming from different directions and crossing each other in this scheme. But it at least allows you to know how many neutrinos roughly you have at any given point and how they are absorbed in the system. So here is a movie showing you how the evolution of the electron fraction on the right and the density on the left is for post-merger disk in the black hole neutron star system. You can see that you will see that you start from a fairly neutron-rich being blue core and some electron fraction of about 0.2 in the low density region, and you are going to rapidly evolve towards an electron fraction of about 0.2 in the high density region of the disk, and much higher electron fractions in the outflows in which you absorb a lot of electron neutrinos.
What mass ratio is this?
This is a disk from a black hole neutron star merger after with a mass ratio of 5 and a spin of 0.8, I think. Yeah. Right, and you can also check what the influence of your treatment of neutrino is. Again, here is the neutrino cooling prescription. Here is the approximate transport. The first row shows you the density. There is basically no difference. Dynamically, it's not very important how you treat the neutrinos. The temperature has some mild effects. It's a little bit more diffuse in the transport scheme because there is heating of cold regions next to hot regions, and there is some heating of low density regions in the disk, especially next to this shark feature here, which is hotter and emits a lot of neutrinos. Where the difference comes in is in the electron fraction, where here the leakage gives you a local prescription which doesn't take into account emission from the hot regions and absorption into the low density region. And it is completely different in those regions from what you get from the transport scheme. So if you want to just get the dynamics and the temperature, you're pretty safe with the leakage scheme. If you want to get the composition, then you actually need to include the full transport. And to summarize what the numerical simulations tells us about actually what those outflows look like, if you have a black hole neutron star merger, the first component, the dynamical ejecta, comes from the tidal disruption of the neutron star. It ejects a lot of material, a few percent to a tenth of a percent of the solar mass. It is very cold and at very low electron fraction, very neutron rich, and so it's going to robustly produce a strong R process nucleosynthesis and infrared type of electromagnetic transient. This one is probably the easiest one to treat. Neutron star mergers are more complicated because there is some matter coming from tidal disruption, but there is also some matter coming from shocks of the two neutron stars as they start interacting. There is generally less material ejected from the early dynamical ejecta, maybe 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 2 solar mass, and a broader range of temperature and electron fraction, because some of it is shocked, some of it is not. Which fraction is shocked and a higher temperature, and generally in that case also higher electron fraction because it absorbs more neutrinos, depend a lot on the compactness of your original neutron star. And so in a way, this could be a trace of the equation of state if you can actually better constrain how this affects the electromagnetic signal. There will definitely be differences with the equation of state, but I don't think we are at a point where we can actually confidently see a light curve and say, oh, this is this kind of compact neutron star. But it's certainly a possibility in the future.
Well, I think especially if you have very low values, it's strongly disfavored some.
I think I'm worried in part in the fact that we don't have many simulations with the proper neutrino treatment to actually get the YE, and we don't have a good understanding of the ratio between this and the late time outflows.
Right, but the late time outflows have larger ones. So when you say
mostly,
right.
Yes. So
you have
not everywhere, not in all directions.
Right. You also need, as you said, you need the right amount of mass. So
yeah.
Only
yeah.
It seems to be that only some particular configurations give you a large amount of low YE.
A large amount of low YE from a neutron neutron star merger would probably give you, that would probably give you some good constraint. Yes, if you had that specific case, that's probably true. Yeah, it would be big neutron stars.
For
low YE?
Yes.
No, for low YE, it would have to be large. Because you would have to need more tidal ejecta.
Yeah, but it seems to be exactly the opposite way.
You need to be in between the case in which you collapse the black hole and the case in which you eject a lot of tidal ejecta.
Yes, but let's discuss
that
later.
And then there's these outflows. So those are generally not followed very accurately by the general heuristic simulation so far. Most of the information we have comes from Newtonian simulations starting from idealized disk conditions. So there's still some work to do to actually get reliable estimates from these, but they have predicted at least that you can eject somewhere between 10 and, in some general heuristic simulations recently, 50% of the mass of the disk through those disk outflows of a longer time scale. That means that in neutron star neutron star merger, it could easily be the dominant source of ejecta, at least if you form an accretion disk and not just collapse everything to a black hole. And in neutron star black hole merger, it's probably subdominant, but it could be a significant contribution nonetheless. And again, those have a fairly large range of temperature and electron fraction because they are emitted from a relatively hot disk with a lot of neutrino emission. They have generally lower velocity, which will affect the time scale over which those disk outflows actually emit electromagnetic counterparts. And they sort of lie at the border between strong R process and weak R process, generally slightly higher YE than higher electron fraction than what would you need to get the strong R process. But it depends a lot on the direction at which you are looking at the system too. And also the fact that we don't have very good initial conditions for those simulations might put some doubt on actually whether you, the current predictions for the electron fraction in the discard flows, which is the more complex probably component here, is well under control. Okay, so I want to spend some time on the other topic too. So let's now conclude for black hole neutron star mergers. We have multiple codes which are rapidly improving the realism of simulations and their accuracy. And the basic results that we can that we get out of those codes, the qualitative features of the merger and the qualitative results are fairly well under control, in my opinion. But the exact quantitative predictions, especially connections to electromagnetic counterparts, still need a fair amount of work. And I've left here a few significant open issues. The first, which I haven't even started to address in this talk, is magnetic fields, and especially how they grow to large scales, and how you might form a jet in accretion disk black hole system after the merger. So that's definitely a very important question that I haven't had the time to touch on today. There is the robustness of the neutrino effects to your treatment of the neutrinos. As we have seen, the two methods that we have right now already give different results. There is no guarantee that the method which is supposedly most accurate of the two actually gives you good enough results to actually predict the light curves. I think it gives fairly accurate results as far as at the accuracy at which we are currently interested in predicting those quantities, but it would be nice to actually check this. And we should also try to figure out what the effect of neutrino anti-neutrino annihilation in those systems is, because neutrino anti-neutrino annihilation from the disk occurring in low density region can significantly affect potentially the production of a jet because it can deposit a large amount of energy in those low density regions. And as mentioned, waveform accuracy is still an important problem, as well as the relative importance of the various components of the outflows. So I'm going to switch gear now and move on to the modeling of accretion disk around supermassive black holes, which is a completely different problem, although a lot of the methods that we use to simulate those systems are fairly similar. So as discussed at the very beginning of this talk, I'm interested in supermassive black holes in which the accretion rate is well below the Eddington rate. And in that regime, you expect the plasma to be largely collisionless. And so we are going to see what the impact of the fact that the plasma is not an ideal fluid, but largely a collisionless plasma, has on the evolution of the disk. And this is in particular the case, the kind of physical setup that you expect in Sagittarius A star and in the black hole at the center of M87, which are the targets of the Event Horizon Telescope, which I'm sure you have heard about from Avery. So what is the basic physics occurring in those systems? Well, you have an accretion disk around the black hole, and you expect that in that accretion disk, the magnetic field is relatively strong because the accretion disk is actually subject to the magnetic rotational instability, or because you have carried magnetic fields from far away from the black hole and frozen in the flow. One way or another, you probably have a very strong magnetic field in those systems, and so the Larmor radius of charged particles is much smaller than the size of the system. But Coulomb collisions at the density and temperature that we expect in those disks are very rare, and so the mean free path of particle, at least along the magnetic field, is extremely large, much larger than the typical size of the disk in those systems. And that goes against one of the fundamental assumptions that you make when you do fluid dynamics, is that usually you assume that the mean free path of particle is much smaller than the radius of than the typical size of your system. So that would be a problem, and in theory, if that was all we had, that means that we would have to actually evolve the distribution function of charged particles in the plasma, and we would have the same problem as for neutrinos in the merger problem, in that it's a high-dimensional problem, in which here we could simply only use the simplification that the distribution function is probably symmetric in the direction perpendicular to the magnetic field, just because the Larmor radius is so small. There is, however, a saving grace for us is in that local simulations have shown that interactions between the magnetic fields and particles cause an effective coupling between the particles, which gives you an effective rate of interaction, which is probably of the order of roughly the size of the system. And so by that point, you can hope to actually treat your collisionless plasmas instead of weakly collisional plasma, which is a perturbation of an ideal fluid. How do you go about that, doing that? Well, we have derived a fairly simple model, which is a first order correction to the ideal MHD equations to actually take, to make a first estimate of the impact of those effects. And this was recently published in an article led by Manichandra, who is a graduate student at the University of Illinois. What you need to include is you correct your stress energy tensor for two components. The first is the heat flux along the magnetic field lines, which accounts for extra energy being carried along the magnetic field lines by those free streaming particles. And the second is the pressure anisotropy between the pressure perpendicular to the field line and the pressure parallel to the field line, which accounts for transport of linear momentum. And in non-relativistic theory, we know what those should be. The heat flux is simply proportional to the gradient of the temperature along the magnetic field with some proportionality constant, which is unconstrained at this point. And the pressure anisotropy is proportional to the shear of the velocity field projected against on the magnetic field with, again, an unknown proportionality constant. If you just set those new variables to these values in general relativity, it's not causal. You have a significant problem. Instead, the simplest way to correct this and to include those non-ideal effects into your evolution equations is to damp your evolved variables towards those non-relativistic equilibrium value on a time scale, which again is unconstrained in the model, to R. And there are all sorts of extra terms here, which comes from the requirement that you have to satisfy the second law of thermodynamics in those with those evolution equations, which is why the equations look a lot more complicated than a simple damping to the equilibrium value. So the model itself is reasonably well motivated from a theoretical point of view, but actually its connection to the underlying physics is potentially problematic. In particular, first, we don't know that it includes all the physics that we need in those collisionless plasma. And second, there are those three parameters here, the constant of proportionality and the damping time scale, which we have to arbitrarily set in our evolutions. So we do that based on comparison with local simulations of particle and cell simulations, which actually include the proper plasma physics. For the damping time scale, the most obvious choice is to take an effective collision time scale, the effective coupling between the particles, which we are going to take to be generally the orbital time scale of the system. So that's your effective coupling length scale is roughly the size of the disk. And for the viscosity and diffusivity, those other constant of proportionality, we know that they should scale like, the collision time scale. If the collision time scale is small, if particles are strongly coupled, you have a nearly ideal fluid, and those viscosity and diffusivity are very small. If it is large, then you get large viscosity and large diffusivity. And there is a constant of proportionality here for each of those, which is of order unity, and which, as we will see, actually doesn't matter at all in our simulations, which is nice because we don't know how to choose them. The reason it doesn't matter is that there is an additional physical effect that we have to take into account in the system, and that is the fact that we observe in local simulations that if the pressure anisotropy becomes of the same order as the magnetic pressure, then the plasma is unstable to, depending on which sign the pressure anisotropy is, either the mirror instability or the fire hose instability. And what happens at that point is that the pressure anisotropy saturates to roughly the magnetic pressure. And this is observed, for example, in the solar wind. This shows you the temperature anisotropy, which is roughly the same as the pressure anisotropy, as a function of the beta parameter of the wind. And those dotted curve and dashed dotted curve here show you the theoretical limit of the mirror and fire hose instability. And you can see that all the particles are basically limited by those two set of curves. So we are going to use that in our model. And the way it is included in the model is that when we reach those instability threshold, we effectively decrease the effective collision time scale so that we drive, so the fluid is closer to an ideal fluid, and effectively this limits the pressure anisotropy to those instability threshold, because the viscosity is proportional to the collision time scale. This is roughly what happens in local simulations, which actually include the physics, but actually getting the edge of that diagram right in our model is something that we cannot reliably do, of course. We just have a rough estimate of, oh, here the pressure anisotropy should saturate. So what happens when we put those models and when we use that model for 2D simulations of accretion disk? And this is just 2D. We haven't done this in full 3D simulations yet. You can see on the left the density of the disk, log density. And at the center will be the heat flux along the magnetic field lines, which is normalized by its saturated value, which is the density times the sound speed cube, at which point, if it's saturated, you will expect a very large effect from the conduction. And the pressure anisotropy is scaled by the magnetic pressure, or twice the magnetic pressure in this case. And the instability threshold here are such that, so if you have a very red region here, you are saturated in the limit of the mirror instability. If you have a bright blue region here, you are saturated in the limit of the fire hose instability, and the yellowish, greenish regions are regions that are not saturated.
So two questions about this.
Yes.
How long did the simulation run before you made these pictures?
This starts after 1,000, so in units of the black hole mass, 1,000 GM over CQ. they are pretty short because it's 2D simulations, and so at first you grow the black lines, so the magnetic field lines, and at first you grow that turbulent field, but because it's 2D, it's going to just dissipate and disappear. And so we can only follow that transient in which first the magnetic field grows and then decreases. That's why we are using those short simulations. At this point, we are really only capable of looking at the general magnitude of the effects. Okay. We are going to move to 3D simulations to actually do longer simulations in which we can reach a steady state. But this is basically motivating the 3D simulations.
Okay, excellent. So would you say that that there are memories of the initial
The entire simulation is a transient. The entire simulation is a transient.
Okay.
There is no steady state reached at any point here. Yes, it's.
And then the other question is: there's a lot of white in the middle plot. What does white mean?
White is below the scale even. So red and orange maybe is strong conduction, but everything else is very low conduction. That's sort of the point: is that during most of the evolution, the conduction remains very small, except at the interface between the funnel and the disk, while the pressure anisotropy is very strongly saturated. And this is something that we see in all the simulations we have done with different equations of state and different initial conditions for the magnetic field. So we think that, and it is also motivated by theoretical argument, that we think that it should be that the pressure anisotropy is going to mostly be saturated at the mirror instability threshold, at which point, Because the pressure anisotropy acts effectively as a shear viscosity, and the shear tensor due to the pressure anisotropy, if it is of the same order as the magnetic pressure, is of the same is similar to the magnetic shear tensor, and so angular momentum, transport, heating, all the effects that you usually associate with the magnetic field are effectively doubled. So that means that because the pressure anisotropy saturates at roughly the magnetic pressure, you get order one effects on the evolution of those disks. Order one effects don't change our general order of magnitude understanding of what happens. It's certainly not going to change the basic results of anything like that the event horizon telescope would first see, which is that the shadow, because that's a geometrical effect that mostly comes from GR, and it's not going to be affected by order one effect in the evolution of the flows. But if you care about all flows, inflows, and detailed emission, then you are actually going to have to take this into account. So it's somewhere in between. It's, our intuition from how those disks behave is fairly good in ideal MHD, but if you actually want to make detailed prediction, you are going to need those order one correction, and not detailed all. And anything that comes within order one effect.
So going back to that, how seriously should I take your disk type? Did this kind of prescribed?
Not at all, I guess. It's a thin disk, of course, but.
Well, frequently, H over R is order 1/3 in the numerical simulations, and yours is 1.
Yeah.
Is that because the anisotropic pressure?
No, so there's a slight difference in the disk heights between the ideal results and the non-ideal results, but this is just the choice of polytropic index and initial conditions that said this here. I think that we'll see what the steady state is in the actual 3D simulations for realistic, at least a gamma equal 5 for the polytropic index. Yeah. But here, there was a slightly thicker disk for the non-ideal simulations with the pressure and isotropy, but it's not an order factor of 3. It's maybe 10-20% difference. It's not really huge, and it's in those 2D simulations, I don't really trust what's happening at the interface between the jet and the disk, because it's very strongly affected by the fact that we are in 2D and by the fact that we are in a transient. I think the fact that we have saturation is a reliable result because we have a good understanding of why it happens. We have good theoretical underpinning from it, and it happens in all the simulations we have done. The actual amplitude of the change in the outflows and inflows, I mean, we know that they are different. We see differences, but I wouldn't say, oh, it's 50% more or 50% less, because for that you need the better simulations, definitely. Okay, we are maybe not doing too much again. So another way to put that pressure and isotropy point is that if you look at the distribution of mass on that same pressure and isotropy versus plasma beta plot that I showed for the solar wind, most of your mass is actually very close to the mirror instability threshold, 50% of the mass. There is a significant amount close to the firewall instability threshold, which is also magnetic pressure of the order of the pressure and isotropy, maybe 10 to 20%. And then most of the rest is actually in regions that are not that have not evolved much by the point of the simulation ends.
So the disk is fairly isotropic, right? You said 10-20%, it's above beta 10.
So in the core of the disk, you get both. You get some mirror instability, some firewall instability, depending on which part of the transient evolution you are in. But most of it is in the positive pressure isotropy. So perpendicular pressure being larger than parallel pressure. In the low beta regime, magnetic limited regime, it's mostly mirror unstable. There is nearly nothing in the fire hose in stable region. This has just to do with how the outflows expand. So that can also be understood theoretically, except that the predictions for the actual outflow are not that great in 2D. So
let me ask a $64,000 question then. So this is the anisotropy distribution function of the ions, mm-hmm. which is cool. What's really observed is, of course, the electrons.
Yep.
Is that saturated as well? I imagine it's saturated very different degrees of anisotropy.
Yeah, so we haven't worked on, I mean, that's one of the next steps, is actually include the art of equilibrium electrons. There has been some work done by Sean Ressler and Sasha Chekhovsky already towards that, in including the conduction for the electrons, but using evolving them on the background, which is from an ideal MHD simulation. Right, so that's the first step, because there was some complication in figuring out how to assign energy to the electrons, which they figured out there. One of the most important next steps is going to 3D. The other is actually having the two-fluid evolution with the electrons and the ions, because this tells me the dynamics of the disk, but it tells me nothing about the actual emission, which is something that we would be clearly interested in. so yes, we need to do the same kind of work for the electrons and understand from local simulations where we need to put the saturation limits, because that's what matters here. And
you could draw your limiting lines for electrons, right? I mean, it's not obvious that they were really dynamically important, so it's not clear that
yeah.
I could still draw lines.
We can you can draw a line, but I don't know how that we compare to the actual pressure and isotropy in the simulations at this point. It's definitely something that we want to answer, but and I don't Yeah, I don't think that that's too complicated a thing to add at this point. So I think a lot of the complicated part of that model have already been worked out. We won't do it before going to 3D because the whole regions from which these electrons are emitting is not believable in 2D. So we do first 3D and then the two fluid. But I think that it's not going to take too long once we get to 3D to actually get the electron model. The important question is whether the model itself is reliable because it's an idealized view of a collisionless plasma. And that will have to be compared with, at least locally with particle simulations. And once we understand which part of the model matters, which for the ions seems to be the saturation, then we can actually work on improving those parts of the model better. Does that answer your question? I'm out of time, right? So let me just for the heat flux, as I mentioned, it's very small, the heat conductivity. And there are two reasons for that. The first is that the temperature gradients are largely orthogonal to the magnetic field. This may or may not be an artifact of 2D. Of course, in 2D, most of the magnetic field is toroidal, sorry. but your temperature gradient by nature are in the orthogonal direction. So that's the suppression factor because you only care about the gradient along the magnetic field lines. And another suppression factor is that because the pressure on isotropy saturates, your effective collision time scale is reduced in your model. And so you have another suppression factor by about an extra order of magnitude. So those are two reasons for which the heat flux is small. The second would be true in 3D as well. The first, we will have to check. But so far, heat flux don't seem to have much of an impact on the evolution of the disks. So to conclude, we know that many accretion disks are in a configuration in which ideal MHD is not a good representation, potentially, of the evolution. They are instead weakly collisional or entirely collisionless plasma. We have done the first set of 2D simulations trying to assess the importance of those non-ideal effects with a simple model to include the first order those non-ideal effects through a pressure isotropy and heat conduction. We find that there are effects of order one due to the pressure and isotropy on the inflows, angular momentum transport, heating of both the corona and the disk, evolution of the entropy. All of those have order one effects on the evolution of the disk. So your basic intuition for the evolution of the disk remain true, but any numerical prediction that you would want to make probably need to take those non-ideal effects into account. And that's what I wanted to talk about today.
Okay, so we had some questions as you were going along, but Francois is going to be here till tomorrow.
Today and tomorrow, yeah.
He's in office 353. Please thank him again.